best for men to do under heaven the few days of their life. I made great works, I built myself houses, I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and parks, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruit. I made myself pools from which to water the forests, springing up with trees. I bought men and women as servants, and had servants born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got myself singers, both men and women, and many concubines, mistresses, for delights of men. And I turned to look upon, So I became great and flourished more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. And also my wisdom stood with me. Nothing that my eyes desired did I keep from them, nor did I withhold my heart from any joy, for my heart had joy in all my labor, and this was my portion from all my labor. And I turned to look upon all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor I had labored to do them, to do it, and just see, all was vanity, and a striving after wind, a chasing after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So this is his project. He follows the path of karmakanda, really. He's taking the enjoyment to which he's entitled, and he's enjoying to the fullest extent. It's nothing that I wanted did I withhold. So the experiment is, let me push pleasure to the maximum allowable extent, and at the same time keep my eyes in my head and watch myself do it, so that I can report the results or evaluate the results of the experiment. And the final report is, what was the use? And there's nothing to it. It's chasing after wind. You know, what is chasing after wind? His experiment with wisdom ends in a similar way. He becomes wiser than all who were before him. But he became, as one commentator says, wiser than it was wise to be. Because he saw that, what's the use of my wisdom? I'll die the same way as the fool. And the only difference is that the more wisdom, the more vexation, the more anxiety, the more angst. So the wisdom experiment fails, the pleasure experiment fails. Now he continues. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a chasing after wind. And I hated the fruit of all my labor at which I had labored under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will be after me. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have power over all for which I have labored, and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore, I turned my heart to despair over all the labor at which I had labored under the sun. For there's a man whose labor is with wisdom and with knowledge and with skill. Yet to a man who has not labored at it, he must leave his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man have from all his labor and from the striving of his heart at which he labors under the sun? For all his days are painful and his occupation vexing. Even at night his heart has no rest. This also is vanity. This is too high.
Yeah.
It's beating back. Who has the power for it? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Okay, that should be good. Everyone can still hear, right?
Yeah.
So then I comment. Now it comes to this. Kohelet's pleasures have turned to gall. Gall. It's like the bad taste that you get when your liver isn't working right.
Maharaj, now you're reading, that's your comment?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah. Something very bitter. The Bhagavad Gita says that this is what we can expect. Come on. Come all the way in because more people will come. Maybe. Bhagavad Gita says, from the union of the senses with the objects of desire comes a happiness at first like nectar, but at the end like poison. Such is happiness in the mode of passion. And happiness and ignorance, with which passion is so often mixed, is still more dismal. Delusion from beginning to end, arising from sleep, indolence, and madness, such is happiness in the world of ignorance. Happiness and goodness, the Gita says, is superior. Though for that happiness one might have to undergo the trouble of self-discipline, of self-restraint, of foregoing what might seem like enjoyment, one eventually finds tranquility, serenity, and joy. At first like poison, but at the end like nectar. Such is happiness in the mode of goodness, born of the satisfaction of knowing oneself. But happiness through goodness, through knowledge, is what Kohelet has already tried and found vexatious. And now he finds happiness in passion has turned bitter. And so, though wisdom, he says, excels folly, as light excels darkness, finally, all is vanity and a chasing after wind. And his work too, in which before he'd said his heart had found pleasure, he has now come to hate. The Hebrew word for labor has a dual meaning. It can refer either to work, to wearisome, burdensome toil, or to the fruit of that work, its payoff, its enjoyable reward. But now Kohelet has found hateful even the fruit of his work, because he knows that after all the labor he has gone through to get it, with so much care and thought and skill, he must leave it to someone else, who may well turn out a fool. One builds up a fortune only to have sons and grandsons squander it. Builds up a business only to have descendants run it into the ground. Builds up a kingdom or empire only to have future generations throw it to the dogs. The path of knowledge and the path of work for one's own enjoyment have both proven useless, empty, absurd. So what is left but despair? The king is not just giving an analytical analysis, a philosophical assessment of life. He's feeling deeply the impact of what he's found. Our English word despair comes from the Latin meaning loss of hope. The Hebrew word can literally mean to give up for lost. Kohelet gives up his heart to despair as he sees that all for which he has worked with such diligence and skill will be left to someone else, someone who did nothing to earn it. Kohelet calls this a great evil, using what one commentator calls an intensity of expression not before employed. So again, Kohelet asks a rhetorical question. What does a human being gain out of all of his work? The answer is clear. Nothing. In the same question, Kohelet employs another phrase which can be literally translated, the desire of his heart. What does one get from the desire of his heart with which he works? One translator renders this as his heart's thoughts. Heart indicates what we might sometimes call the mind, the center of our thoughts. I had my heart set on it. The Bhagavad Gita, too, observes that such desires are coming forth from the mind and born of some notion in the heart. Elsewhere, the Gita even speaks of one who desires to desire. Kama kama, one who desires to desire. That is, we get some notion in our mind, some thought of enjoyment, and we start ruminating on it, thinking about it, picturing it, letting our imagination run with it, pumping it up, and so the notion grows. My spiritual teacher called this agitating the mind for sense gratification, stimulating the mind with thoughts of what we imagine our senses might enjoy. The Gita says this can never lead to peace. Our minds agitated with thoughts of enjoyment, we work hard to fulfill our desires, and we wind up with nothing. Our only reward is the pain of work and a mind so troubled that even at night we cannot rest. Again, Kohelet laments, despairs, that this is all vain, empty, pointless, absurd. Any questions so far?
It's almost like committing a suicide. Suicidal thinking.
That question certainly arises. I when I first read the book, I naturally thought of suicide. If you really get it, if you read it, the message really goes in, you say, well, what am I living for? I'm living a life for nothing. My search for knowledge is going to lead me to the conclusion that knowledge is useless. My search for happiness, for enjoyment, is going to reach the conclusion that enjoyment is mad. My good work is going to result in some profit that's going to go elsewhere, that's going to be left behind, perhaps to a fool or a vagabond, not a vagabond, a profligate, a spendthrift. What am I living for? So it does, it can very much lead to a despondent state of mind, a hopelessness, despair. Despair is one step from suicide.
So that will be, let's say, one kind of human being with that kind of experience. But what about somebody else writing a book or having that positive thinking and, you know, everything is actually...
Carmelo says he's a bigger fool. Bhagavatam also says that. The Paramahansas and the fools are happy. Paramahansas are happy because they're Paramahansas. They're always in touch with the absolute truth. They're enjoying unlimited, eternal ecstasy. And the fools are happy because they're fools. They don't see the nature of what it is they're enjoying. I remember when we had our temple, or when I was living in our temple at Second Avenue in New York, it was like really an area full of drunkards and bums. Bowery was not very far away. And you'd see these men, like in the middle of the winter, camped out next to some trash, municipal trash can, where they make a fire out of paper and stuff. And typically an arm would be in a sling, you know, because they'd knock themselves down sometime and gotten patched up somewhere, and their faces would be all bruised and distorted, and they'd be singing because they were drunk. So Bhagavatam says the fools are happy. Avaranatmika Shakti, the bewildering energy of Maya, covers them so thoroughly that while suffering like dogs, they think, not so bad. So the Paramahansas and the fools are happy, but those who are between them feel the pricks of their situation, of our predicament in this material world. So the fools, what can we say? They're fools. But those of us who are not such fools can understand this message. More and more people in Kali Yuga are fools. Positive thinking. Will you overcome death by positive thinking? Will you overcome disease? Maybe you'll overcome a disease, but you won't overcome disease. Nor old age. The miseries of material existence inflict themselves on the pessimists and the optimists also.
Would that be similar to the analogy that we had, that in the heavenly planets, a lot of enjoyment, Patala Loka, or the hellish planets, a lot of suffering, Martya Loka, were in between?
Yeah, this earth plane is considered better, because in hellish planets, you're suffering too much to even think about spiritual realization. In the heavenly planets, you're enjoying too much, but here we can take it seriously. Elsewhere, Kuhelt even says, better the house of mourning than the house of feasting. A sober person thinks about janma mrityudra adhyadi dukkadeshan, miseries of material existence. Better the house of mourning than the house of feasting. And one commentator says that even when the wise man is not in the house of mourning, the house of mourning is always within him.
Something else?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
You read the thoughts originate in the heart. Is it literally heart, or is the soul you are referring to?
the Sanskrit equivalent, well, in the text he says the heart, he said, and the commentators say that heart in this usage means the mind. So when I think about it, I think about citta. The Sanskrit equivalent would be citta, which is sometimes translated mind, sometimes translated heart. It's your consciousness. It's your consciousness. It may not exactly be the soul. Ultimately, the source is the soul, because it's only the soul that's conscious. But it's the soul in touch with the material energy. So when we say, follow your heart, it doesn't mean exactly follow your soul. It means follow your contaminated consciousness. That's the mistake of the New Age. You know, just follow your heart. Your heart will lead you to but the problem is that the heart is contaminated. Yes.
Sometimes, in the modern world, they say it is the journey, it is the means which are important, like not the end, but the process we are following.
That's stupid. That it's what matters is the journey, the process, and not the end. So what matters is getting on the airplane and not getting to your destination. Working, but not. What matters is Monday through Friday, and not the day you get your paycheck. Yeah, that's all theoretical. But what matters is the journey, but not the end. Why be on a journey if you don't care about reaching any place? What does a journey mean? A journey means you're trying to get somewhere. If you're not trying to get somewhere, you're aimless. Mm-hmm.
What about how they mentioned in spiritual pursuances, like how you can fail materially, but you can still gain spiritually.
Yeah.
That's kind of like the journey, isn't that?
You can gain, no. I mean, it is a journey. It's a spiritual journey. You can gain, fail materially, but gain spiritually. But it's not like we're just interested in journeying. We join the Krishna consciousness movement so that we can be on an endless journey. We have a destination. We have a goal. We want to serve Krishna. We want to reach Krishna, go back to Krishna. It's not that we just want to journey forever. So if we fail materially, okay. But if I'm making spiritual progress, just like sometimes in politics, you lose a battle so that you can win the war. But you have a destination. Imagine you're fighting a battle, you're fighting a war, but you don't really care, it's not really for any purpose. I'm just here to fight because, in one sense, Krishna says to Arjuna, don't care about winning or losing, but you have a purpose still to serve me. It's not that the purpose of fighting is just to fight for no reason.
Has the author created a hypothetical situation, or is the canon someone...
Well, this is an interesting question. Did the author create a hypothetical situation? A lot of ink has been spilt over this. Some say that these are the true words of King Solomon. This is Solomon in his old age reflecting. Others say that this is a literary device, that the author is putting on the mask of King Solomon and in that way putting himself in the situation of the person who has it all, who has the most wealth, who has the most wisdom, and demonstrating that even if you become King Solomon, you won't be satisfied. You can take it either way. Yes?
It sounds to me that what he lacks and what he might be trying to search for is a guru. And if we look at people in general now, they know that something is wrong, they're kind of like lost, but they just don't know who to approach.
Yes.
Who has the right answers. Is that something that you address in your
commentary in the podcast? I definitely address this issue that one needs to, if one wants to get knowledge, vidyan artham sadhu may not be get to. One has to approach a person who has knowledge. And that's effective, in essence, a distinguishing characteristic of Kohelet, that he tries to figure everything out by himself. His approach is very much an empirical approach. He never says, this is what I heard from my ancestors, this is what I read in scripture, this is what I've learned from sages. It's all, this is what I saw, that's what I saw, I said to myself, and then I thought. He never refers to enlightened authority. So in one sense, it's an object lesson or a case history of where a person goes trying to figure everything out on his own. He winds up in despair.
Is it really possible to realize by oneself without having a guru?
Excuse me?
Is it possible to realize, like, without having a guru, like, by himself, everything?
Can one realize everything by himself without having a guru?
Is it really possible?
Theoretically, it may be possible. Prabhupada gave the example of Rabindranath Tagore. He never attended university or got a degree, but he won the Nobel Prize because he was the author of Gitanjali and some of the great poetic works. So is it possible to win the Nobel Prize without getting an education? It's possible. Can you become a great author without? Yes, it's possible. Is that the recommended way? No. Just like you may get an appointment, who was it? Albert Einstein, he was working as a clerk somewhere.
Intellectual
property office. And he became the greatest physicist. So, but then you say, well, I'm not going to go to school, I'll just be like Albert Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
So the real conclusion is it possible? No, it's not possible. And then we may say, well, in some rare case, if Krishna gives causeless mercy, it may be possible. But you can't take that path, Prabhupada. I'll be the exception. I'll be the one out of a million. Why do that? Yeah.
Just to add to that statement, it is possible to do the things, but what is important is, it is, you know, important to do the things in a right way.
Yeah. So the right way is to approach the authority.
Yeah. That's what it means.
And we can invent our own process and say, well, I'll figure it out by myself. But that's not recommended. Even the simplest thing, you know, what is this? Or, you know, like anything, your cell phone, you try and figure it out. You'll never figure out all the doodads in your cell phone. You know, you read the manual or you ask somebody, how does this work? And what to speak of figuring out life.
Is that what Sankhya philosophy is?
Sankhya philosophy is guided analysis.
So there is a guru involved.
Yeah, the gurus there. Sankhya philosophy is not just, well, let me figure it all out. There's teachers, there's a whole tradition that we rely on. It's not just, well, let me look at the will and figure out that it's, therefore it's a philosophy. It's not just spontaneous speculation.
I think in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna talks to Uddhava, and he's mentioned that, yes, you can become, or a person can become a guru after analyzing so many, you know, things about life. You could become, but it's so difficult. It's very rare.
Yeah, this is not the recommended way, again. Exceptionally, one can learn something. But you probably gave the example that you can go to the top of the Empire State Building by the elevator, or you can go by walking. So walking is a slow, laborious process. And probably gave that example actually about yoga systems. You go by this yoga, by that yoga. But this is even more difficult because at least the stairs up the Empire State Building are straight. You know where you're supposed to go. And they take you, you know, 20 days to get up there, but you'll go. But the material world set up in such a way that you don't know where you're going. This way, go that way, wrong turn, second wrong turn, third wrong turn, fourth wrong turn. Can everybody in practical, who here doesn't use a GPS? You know, all of you independent-minded people for whom just the journey is the thing. When given a choice, you turn on the GPS and somebody talks to you and says, you know, half a mile, turn right, now turn left, no, turn left. So for such a simple thing as from getting from here to there, just like our Matt, he's from London, so he's living on the other side of town, and he didn't know how to get here, but I guess you looked in Google Maps or something like that? Google Maps, GPS, and here he is. He didn't just sit there and say, well, it's someplace east. If you want to get somewhere, then you follow the authority. Something else?
How much is your book is going to end up like just the king is a loser?
You have to be a little louder.
Is the book is going to end up like just the king is a loser, or you have
is the king a loser?
That's why I understand.
Well, I don't say that at the end of the book, well, this king is a real loser. But you know what he is? There's a commentator who's really described him nicely in a very few words. He says, he's a confused wise man. You know, the person who's seeking wisdom is better than the person who doesn't care, who's a fool. They're the real losers, people who never even ask, why am I here, why am I suffering? They're the absolute losers. So Kohelet's not like that. He's on the path of Brahma Jigyasa. He's on the path of inquiry. But he's confused. Yes?
Maharaj, Kohelet is, what Kohelet is saying, so what I want to ask is, if a man works righteously, honestly, and he creates things, plants trees, like, let's say, do some things with people, can make use of, and suppose creates wealth, and then he dies, maybe his sons will be good, virtuous or not, but in the process he develops compassion, tolerance, and so his conclusion, Kohelet's conclusion that there was no gain,
yes.
I don't think it's, there was some gain, like not as
there's
much.
There's some gain, but the gain will be lost.
He
improved his mind, but then he dies. And then it's all for nothing. Either death is the end and then it's nothing, or he comes back in another lifetime. And will he be compassionate? Will he be wise? Will he even be a human being?
So maybe he will improve from whatever level he achieved in this life. Like that's what I believe he will go up from there.
He may, but this is called karmakanda, and I have a long discussion of it. Actually, what the king is doing is essentially following the path of karmakanda, or pious activities, punya karma. We don't read, you know, I had sex with other men's wives, I killed people for pleasure. You know, he did pious things. He planted trees, he built wells, he gave charity, he, you know, everything legitimate. And even it's all natural things, you know, vineyards and flocks. And I built factories and poisoned the environment. It's all pious activities. So this is there in the Vedic literature. But the conclusion in the Vedic literature is that karmakanda will give me some, like a bank balance of credit, punya, but my bank balance will be spent. It's not a permanent credit. Suppose I become very pious, exceedingly pious, I may go to Indraloka, Swarga. And from the Bhagavad Gita we learn one can live there for thousands and thousands of years. But while I'm there and enjoying, I'm using up my bank balance of punya. And when it's exhausted, punya, shine punya marchilo kondishanti. I come back down. That means I worked, I strived, I developed all these good qualities, assets. I went up to a higher realm. Then I came back to where I started. There's a nursery rhyme, which those of you who are from India probably didn't grow up with. But my mother tells me it was my favorite nursery rhyme when I was a child. It's called the Itsy Bitsy Spider. You know the Itsy Bitsy Spider. The Itsy Bitsy Spider, this is Shastra. Itsy Bitsy Shastra climbed up the water spout. Down came the rain and washed the spider out. Out came the sun and dried up all the rain. And the Itsy Bitsy Spider climbed up the spout again. This is the business of punya. We climb up the spout, we go all the way up to Indraloka or Chandraloka. Then we get washed out, our punya is exhausted, we come back down here, we start all over again. We go up and come down and come through. What are we achieving?
Does the king ever offer any explanation of why he doesn't suit that teaching? Does he just live his whole life?
No, he never does say that.
So
it never seems to occur to him. He just doesn't show up in the book. No.
So he just gives a pessimistic opinion at the end that it's always.
Well, yes, at the end, his conclusion is this, his closing words are the same as his opening words. All is vanity. Then a narrator comes in and sort of adds a nice little flourish and says, well, here's the real conclusion. You should just serve God, fear God, and follow his commandments. But Kohelet himself never really settles on that conclusion. Yes?
What you give in this book, like a conclusion or your complaints about
what? Yeah, I will give a conclusion in the book. I don't. I'm just not just on a journey. But by the end of the book, one pretty much gets a primer in Krishna consciousness. If you go through the book from the beginning to the end, you'll get something from every chapter of Bhagavad Gita, from every canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. You'll get all the basic siddhantas that Srila Prabhupada taught. That's my purpose. Otherwise, the comment on the Bible is not my prescribed duty, but for that purpose.
Maharaj, the karma you mentioned in the book, is it your commentary or is it from the original book?
No, the commentary is mine.
Okay.
Although I've referred to many, many commentators, and great commentators, but this commentary is mine.
So how did you relate vanity versus the karma? Like, how did you relate this to me?
How is vanity? Well, the meaning of the title, why vanity karma? That's your question. Vanity means, a big theme in Kohelet is work. And I labored under the sun, and the work for which I, the profit for which I labor. So a big theme in Kohelet is work. And the big theme, you could say the headline of Kohelet is vanity. Uselessness. So you can translate vanity karma, working for nothing, or acting for no purpose, or even living for nothing.
In the beginning you mentioned that those who are self-realized paramahamsas are happy, those who are foolish are happy, the rest of us are suffering. So what about the situation in which the rest of us live in a society or in a world that's becoming increasingly hellish? it's not really, you're not sure if it's even the middle ground or not.
We're not what about the, let's say, the prime hunters and the fools are happy, but the world is becoming increasingly hellish.
Yeah, but the fools, I mean, the fools are suffering, or the people in hell are suffering because it's just so overwhelming misery.
Mm-hmm.
And this world is actually becoming like that.
Yeah, the world is becoming more and more hellish, and as people become more and more foolish, they think, oh, you know, we're making progress.
Mm-hmm.
Or they think, wow, I could never have done this 20 years ago. They think that they're, you know, like, for example, to give one department of activities. If you go to a college now, an American college or university, you can have sex like a cocker spaniel. The facility for sexual engagement between the male and female students, or between the male and male students, or the female and female, is just, it's really expansive. And so the students think this is the life. This is enjoyment. But the result is actually suffering. They become more frustrated, more unhappy, sometimes more diseased. They think that it will be enjoyable. That's called Maya. The appearance of enjoyment, but the fact of suffering. Yehi samsparsha jag bhoga dukkha yonye. That's Maya's trick. The fish thinks it's going to be pleasure, but really it's the hook. That's Maya's arrangement. Come on, enjoy. Come on, enjoy. And what is that enjoyment? Suffering. That's Maya. We're on the path of a progressive civilization. But what is it? More pollution. More anxiety. More hard work. More exploitation. More war. More weapons, more fear. That's all that our advancement.
There's sometimes in trying to explain to some people I have met, people that when I explain about the difficulty.
What happens if we turn that one fan off? Does it become unpleasant or uncomfortable? That's the loud fan.
So I'm meeting sometimes people explaining Bhagavad Gita or the inconveniences, the difficulties and obstacles in life. Some people said, and I found a few of them, I don't know if they bluff, they're true to the word, but they say like this, actually, I derive some kind of...
Oh, that's so much. All those positive ions in the name of enjoyment, right?
They say they derive some thrive, the pleasure, that actually is a challenge. It gives me a goal to keep going, and I disregard all those negative.
That's called avaranatmaka shakti. Maya has two potencies, prakshepatmika, the throwing potency that throws us into this material world, and avaranatmaka shakti, the covering potency. First, she throws you down there, and then she convinces you. Oh, it's not so bad. Again, drunkards, you know, first they get like thrown into the gutter, and then they get convinced by their own illusions that, hey, I'm in heaven. That's Maya's power. The pig is, you know, especially those who've spent time in India, you see these pigs in like the middle of, you know, just wallowing in filth with these enormous smiles on their face. Yeah. Yeah, they're leading the life of rightly. They're in heaven. Why? Because they're so covered by illusion. If I told you, now you go live like that, you'd say, how could I live like that? But the pig is so covered by Maya that the pig thinks, This is great.
Your previous statement was about happiness. And if I say, like, going out to a movie with my parents and going out to a hotel with my friends is what brings me happiness. So what's your statement on happiness?
What
happiness
do you
define happiness?
The happiness is that now you've seen the movie,
yeah.
You've been to the hotel, you have less money in your pocket.
I bought happiness.
You bought happiness, and the happiness is now worn off. You got 15 minutes of happiness, or an hour's happiness, or 2 hours of happiness. Now you have to go back to work to fill your pocket again so that you can do the same thing again. So Bhagavad Gita says, that's not happiness. It has a beginning, it has an end. So Krishna says, the intelligent person doesn't take pleasure in that kind of happiness. Brahma Sokyam Sunantam. He wants unlimited happiness. He wants limited happiness that lasts. Just like if I say that I'll rent you an apartment, and it'll be very nice and very pleasant, nice view, nice furniture, and you can live there for 15 minutes. Well, you say, well, that's great, 15 minutes. The first thing you do when you rent an apartment, you want to make sure that you can stay. Right? They can't kick you out.
I understand. So, what's your definition of happiness?
Happiness means permanent. If it's not permanent, it's not happiness. Happiness, real happiness, comes not from buying this or having that. It comes from the soul. The nature of the soul is to be happy. Anandamayavyasa. And because our soul is not happy, we try to patch the situation by buying this or getting that or trying this or doing that. And Kohelet says, you'll never be satisfied that way. Krishna says, you'll never be satisfied that way. It's always, well, that was okay, but man. No, not that your heart feels... You went to the movie and now your heart just feels filled to the brim with happiness. Right? How was the movie? It was okay. Or it was really good. But your heart doesn't feel fulfilled. And now my life is... No. It's just a little, like a drop of water in the desert. It's water. That's what you need. But it's that much water. So we need a lot of water. That comes from the soul itself. And the soul is happy when he's connected with the source of happiness, Krishna. Soul is spiritual, Krishna is spiritual. And when the spiritual connection is revived, then the soul becomes superseded, fully satisfied. Otherwise, it comes, it goes. At the end of the life, at your life, yeah, I saw a lot of movies. Yeah, I went to a lot of hotels. You know, what is that? But if at the end of your life you can say, I gave my heart to Krishna, I gave my service to Krishna, I lived in Krishna consciousness, and your life is successful, then at the end you go back to Krishna. Where will you go as a result of so many movies? Heart is, the mind is filled with this, that. And what is the movie? Another car chase, another... right, another explosion, another bang, 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 another woman takes off her clothes. You know what I'm saying? Those kinds of movies are good. Just like books, they're useless. Novels, fiction. But if there's a book about Krishna consciousness, that's wonderful. If there's a movie about Krishna consciousness that brings us closer to Krishna, that's wonderful. that speaking about some of the things is useless, but if we can speak about Krishna, yeah, that's exactly.
If you just can take Krishna, you know, wherever you go, if you travel, if you go to some beautiful place in the mountains, or you go to the ocean or something, then it's something that, you know, contributes to your appreciation of life.
Mm-hmm. The beneficial thing is not really going to the mountain.
It's
that you're thinking of Krishna. Now, going to the mountain or going to the beach may help you a little bit. You look and you see, it's like that. You go to a natural place and it's in the mode of goodness and you become reflective and you appreciate Krishna. So in that sense, it can be favorable. Yeah. Srila Prabhupada used to say that the liquor house is in the mode of ignorance, and the city is in the mode of passion, and the country is in the mode of goodness. So the countryside is good for reflectiveness, for peaceful contemplation, for tranquility. But the temple is transcendental. One place is in the mode of ignorance, next is in passion, next is in goodness. The place where people are chanting Hare Krishna, speaking about Krishna, hearing about Krishna, that's even better than the country. That's transcendent.
Maharaj, are there any symptoms of real happiness, maybe just no?
Yes, that's described in Bhagavad Gita. Prasannatma. Nishokshati nakamshati. Brahma-bhuta, when one's happiness comes from self-realization, these are two symptoms. Nashochati, he doesn't lament about anything. Nakankshati, he doesn't yearn for anything. The materialist is always lamenting about what he's lost or aspiring for what he doesn't have. But the person who's spiritually happy, nothing to lament about, nothing to aspire for. Samasarveshu bhuteshu. He sees all circumstances and all living beings with an equal eye. And from that platform, he goes further. Madhaktin lavate for that. He comes to the actual spiritual platform of realization. So he goes into the next step, serving Krishna.
In this age,
most of the people know that they are doing something wrong, still they do it.
Yeah, that's a symptom of passion and ignorance. In Satya Yuga, goodness was predominant. There was hardly any.
But now, because of the Kali
Yuga. In the Kali Yuga, passion and ignorance, increasingly ignorance. Therefore, we see people are vicious, people are frustrated, people are sinful, people are foolish. Mandasu manda matayo manda bhagya. They're very slow in spiritual realization, or even in ordinary intelligence, you know, real intelligence, not mathematical engineering, but in terms of spiritual awakening, very slow. Sumanda matayo, misguided by so many false gurus, false professors, false politicians, false leaders. Mandapagya, therefore, always unfortunate. And upadruta, always in anxiety. America is the most advanced country in the world. Yeah, we've got more money, we've got more things, we've got more freedom, we've got more everything. And therefore, we should have the happiest people in the world. That everyone should be. I mean, you go to India, it's a poor country, and they don't have this, and they don't have that. But you come to America, and everything works, and everything's, you know. Therefore, everybody should be walking around contented with big smiles on their faces. Right? But what do we see? frustration, bitterness, anxiety, madness, desperation. Why? We have more money, we have more sex, we have more everything.
Problems.
Hmm?
More money, more problems.
More money, more problems. Yeah. You have big universities, people throw themselves off the tower. You know.
Being at the beginning of the golden age, do we need to be overly concerned about Kali Yuga? Like, really talk about it and immerse ourselves in how bad it is? Cause
golden age isn't just a... Well, okay, there's supposed to be a golden age on account of Lord Chaitanya's movement. Now, you can just do nothing about it, and it will come anyway, but then you don't get any credit. Just like the American Revolution, let's say it was destined to happen, and America was destined to get freedom from Great Britain and destined to become a great, great country. So if you sort of see that coming, and therefore you sit by the sidelines and say, well, it's going to happen anyway, you don't get any credit.
I didn't mean take part, but to put aside the whole idea of being consumed in Kali Yuga discussions and how bad it is, when actually we can take part in this coming golden age.
But that stimulates the golden age. The golden age exists in response to the miseries of Kali Yuga, the badness of Kali Yuga. If we don't see how... Therefore, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's speaking in Bhagavad Gita, that you should surrender to me, you'll get unlimited happiness. You'll get shanti, you'll get peace. But he also says, Janmamrityu jara vyadhi dukkha dosha vidarshan. You should always keep in mind the miseries of birth, death, disease, and old age. This is part of the process of knowledge. If I don't keep those things in mind, then I start to be covered by Maya. I think, well, that's not so bad, really. I just got a new iPad for my birthday and things are looking up. So we do need to have, just like a person who's having a great time and he has no fiscal control. It's all on his credit card and he has nothing to back it with. And why should he look at that? Why should I be concerned about my overdraft? Today I'm enjoying, and all that matters is now. Right? The future hasn't come yet, and why worry about the future? Live in the moment. That's the philosophy of fools. Then he'll live in the next moment where the bank is knocking on his door and taking away his car, taking away his phone, taking away his furniture. Intelligent person sees the whole picture. Credit cards again. People are so foolish. Everything goes on the credit card. It's so easy. So, and what are they paying? It's like 29%. What's the credit card rate? 15 to 25% interest. People used to go to jail for charging that kind of interest. 15 to 25% interest. I work so hard to spend one quarter of my money on nothing. Just on the privilege of being able to have it now. You have to be mad. And people not only do that, but then when they realize what they've gotten themselves into, they move the debt to another credit card. And run up a second debt. What is that? A thoughtful person, therefore Krishna says, Dhira, one should be sober. What is my enjoyment? The privilege of being indebted to the bank for the rest of my life? Or having to spend the rest of my life crawling out of debt? And what is that? But because the mind is rolling, if I had this, if I had that, if I had this, if I had that, charge it, charge it, charge it. Because they don't know that their happiness is within. If I chant Hare Krishna, what does it cost to chant Hare Krishna? You don't have to put it on your credit card. Just chant. It's free. I can go to the movie for $20 and I can chant Hare Krishna for nothing. And they'll feed me besides. So what's the better night out? And the movie enjoyment will be gone. And the pleasure I get from Krishna consciousness will be my permanent asset.
In this part that old age and disease, mm-hmm. So old age and disease, they lead to death. Like finally, like old age and disease, like ultimately lead to death.
Mm-hmm.
And Krishna says like death is just like changing clothes, soul
mm-hmm.
changes clothes.
Mm-hmm.
So death is not that bad.
No, it's not that bad. For the self-realized person. Even for the self-realized person, you say it's not that bad. Death is not fun. Even for the self-realized person, death is not a joyride. Death means it's excruciating pain. And death means fear, I don't know where I'm going. So yes, the self-realized person, for him death is just like lightning and thunder coming together, you know, just one clap and he's gone. And the person who's actually on that platform, he's beyond suffering. But he's beyond suffering because he's realized how bad this material world is, and therefore he's taken exclusive shelter of Krishna. If I don't realize the effect of disease, I won't be able to enjoy the benefits of health. Part of being healthy is avoiding, you know, like, don't drink bad water, don't stay out in the sun too long. Don't do this, don't do that, because if you do this, 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 this will happen, that will happen. Don't have sex with anyone and everyone. If you want to enjoy health, you have to know what disease is. What causes disease, how to avoid disease. The world is not such a place where everyone's automatically going to be healthy. I have to know I can't eat too much, I can't eat the wrong things. So, the self-realized person transcends death because he understands how miserable this world is, old age, disease, and death, and therefore he transcends it by coming to the spiritual platform. If we don't understand that, for the person who's not self-realized, death is the ultimate misery. For one who's sure of going back to Godhead, or one who's fully engaged in Krishna consciousness, death is not a problem. For one who wants to enjoy this material world, that's a different story.
So there are like two things. One is that like not taking birth at all again,
mm-hmm.
and one is like if one tries, like understands in this way that Krishna says like death is not this, so even if we die, we think like just changing the body, so but not targeting, not ever taking birth, but by thinking that by death the body will change, so,
mm-hmm.
so then
he's philosophical, he's not really trying to go back to God, but he's philosophical, he's just thinking, well, it's another change of body, but that's all right, that's all right. He's, in one sense, that's good. That even if I don't become fully Krishna conscious, at least I realize I'm not this body. And I realize that the change of body is not what's really happening to me. It's happening to the body. Impersonalists are on that platform. They have self-realization. They know they're not the body. They know that death is just a change of body. But they don't have the spiritual connection with Krishna. Still, they're transcendentalists. They've gone beyond the bodily platform. They just haven't gone further. But they're actually transcendentalists. They've given up this material world and they've come to the spiritual platform. If we want to enjoy this material world and just sort of trivialize the problems of death, that's not recommended. You know, have our cake and eat it too. That I'll enjoy this material world and I won't worry about death because death is just a change of body. But when I'm trying to enjoy this material world, then I'm not going to be on that spiritual platform. And therefore death is going to hurt. In other words, there's no cheating. Kaitava Dharma. In the Bhagavatam, this is called cheating religion. What is that cheating religion? Dharmartha Kama Moksha. Where I live a religious life in order to be prosperous and satisfy the desires that I have and finally attain liberation. The Bhagavatam says this is cheating because it doesn't touch my real purpose in life to revive my eternal natural constitution, to revive my relation with Krishna. So it just has me, generally people get lost, you know, they think, Dharmartha Kama Moksha, yes, Dharmartha, but how interested are they in moksha even? Not really. How interested are they in dharma even? It's basically Artha Kama. People are pursuing wealth for sense gratification. And they speak of Dharmartha Kama Moksha, but there's hardly any moksha and there's less and less dharma. And even if they attain moksha, that's still not the perfection. Because higher than moksha is devotional service, which is our real business.
Mm-hmm. Krishna says in Gita, one of the four people that come to him is the Artharthi, the one who wants to earn wealth.
Mm.
So is that because they realize it's a cheating religion and they decide?
Not exactly. Artharthi, those who are looking for wealth, they're sukritina. Not everyone who's looking for wealth, but a person who's got some sukriti, a background of punya karma. Fortunately, while he's looking for wealth, he thinks, well, let me go to Krishna for wealth. Just like Dhruva Maharaj. He was after a kingdom, that's all. He wasn't looking for spiritual realization. It was all about a kingdom. But because he was fortunate, he received the advice that, well, if you really want to get a kingdom, then only God can give you the kingdom that you want. All right, where's God? So, a fortunate person. He may be looking for wealth. He may be looking for wisdom. He may just be in distress and looking for a way out of that. He may be curious, but because he's fortunate, he goes toward Krishna. Whereas the unfortunate person, he denies God. So a fortunate person. But Krishna says out of those four, the one who's looking for knowledge is especially dear to me. Especially dear to me. But if we come to Krishna through the front door, the back door, the side door, any door.
We say that not the blade of grass moves without Krishna's sanction.
Yeah.
So how much is our independence or our choice?
Very little. How much not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Lord? But we have our tiny independence. We can't blame everything on Krishna, you know, Adam, but, well, I went to the pub because it was Krishna's. It was my arrangement. Or it was Krishna's arrangement. Krishna knew this rascal wants to go to the pub. And Tasmitir Gyanam Polanam Chak, from within the heart, Krishna says, all right, he wants to be a rascal, I'll help him be a rascal. Or he wants to come toward me, I'll help him come toward me. I'll give him remembrance or I'll give him forgetfulness, whichever he wants. So in that sense, nothing goes on without Krishna's stamp of approval or Krishna's arrangement. But it doesn't mean that, therefore, whatever we do, that's Krishna's desire. No, he says, Sarvadharman Pratyajya Mahamekam. Give up all your rascal and surrender to them. Is that okay?
I'm just curious to know the time when he was born and how is it that he missed the opportunity to take part in love?
How?
The time that he was born and the time when Lord Chaitanya appeared.
Oh.
Yeah, but it seems that
big
he
gap.
Appear, so.
The, well, it depends who you listen to. Everything about this book, Kohelet, has been debated, and they say that every scholar has a different opinion. But one commentator, he said, yeah, it's sort of an old saying about Kohelet, there's many interpretations as there are interpreters. But one scholar, he said, actually more, because some of the interpreters have changed their mind.
Mm-hmm.
So opinions are all over the place about everything about the book, including when it was written. If you believe it was written by King Solomon, then you're going back maybe 3,000, 5,000 years. If you follow sort of the modern consensus of scholars, you're going to about 300 BC. So well before the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Old book. Let's see, shall we stop here? More questions? Tell me what to do. Little kirtan and then prasadam.
Yes.
That's what we do, isn't it?
Kirtan.
Philosophy, kirtan, kirtan. Okay.